Hello, everyone, and welcome to the continuation of our interview with clarinetist Anthony McGill. Anthony tells us the story behind performing at Barack Obama's 2008 inauguration, what activities he does to find balance in his life, the reason of starting the social media movement Take Two Knees. He answers questions about the Met Orchestra, the New York Philharmonic, and so much more. Let's dive right into it.
We would like to thank our corporate sponsor, US Pave. For any of your commercial or residential paving needs, please visit uspave.com. US Pave, the national paving company.
Anthony, are there any exercises you do to be strong mentally for different situations?
I like to meditate, and I like to give myself positive self-talk whenever I desperately need it. Yeah, so those are some of them.
So one of the biggest moments of your career was performing for Barack Obama's inauguration back in 2008, when you performed with cellist Yo-Yo Ma, violinist Itzhak Perlman, and pianist Gabriela Montero. First of all, had you collaborated with them before, and how did the opportunity come about?
I collaborated with Yo-Yo a couple years before in Japan. Mm-hmm. We did a Messian quartet for The End of Time.
Nice.
With Mitsuko Uchida and Marina Piccinini and Mark Steinberg and Yo-Yo. And that was like an amazing, amazing experience. And I guess it was the fall of 2008 that I got the phone call about doing a concert in January of the following year. And that concert happened to be at the inauguration and with those players that you had mentioned. And I had never played with Itzhak or Gabriela before. So that's how that came about. I think the story is that Yo-Yo Ma and Itzhak were asked to do this performance, and John Williams was going to be involved writing the piece, and they were talking. And I think Yo-Yo happened to be in Baltimore at some time after this, and he was at a soiree or something, and he found out that I was teaching at the Peabody Conservatory at the time, where I don't teach now. And there was some conversation about what I was up to, and we had already played together many years before. And I think at that point, he got the idea to invite me to be a part of this inauguration performance. And John Williams liked the idea. And, you know, the rest is history. So it was like, yeah, I think it was the highlight of my entire life to be a part of that moment in time. Part of that moment in history. So I was very lucky. I mean, there are a lot of personal reasons, of course, that it was a complete honor to do so. But, you know, I was from Chicago, and, you know, he was a community organizer in Chicago, mm-hmm. President Obama was. And, you know, there were just all of these like strange, interesting kind of connections. And I, you know, it's not something that you would ever expect to be able to do in your life. Mm-hmm. And so that happened and changed my life.
Did you get to hang with Barack and Joe after?
I didn't get to hang with Barack.
No.
I didn't even get to meet him. I didn't get to meet President Obama until last year.
Oh,
until
nice.
2020. We were doing a recording for something with the Philharmonic, and he and John Williams and Michelle Obama and Bruce Springsteen and Steven Spielberg were all in the room.
Wow.
And that's when I got to meet him.
What'd you guys talk about?
Well, there were like 100 people in the space. So
Literally
was one of these people that went up to him after one of the breaks. And John Williams introduced me and said, you know, this guy played at your inauguration. He's like, oh, nice. Yeah. And so it was very friendly, but very brief. But I finally got to say I met him, you know, because this many years on, it was starting to get like really weird for me, not for him.
Yeah,
I don't think it was weird for him.
So you're telling people you're like best friends with him now?
Yeah, exactly. We hang. Yeah.
So you've been very busy during the pandemic, Anthony. What do you do to keep your mind always fresh? You talked about a little bit about meditation. Anything else?
You know, when I'm in the best zone, you know, I like exercise. I get on the Peloton bike. I play golf. I like to be outside, see the sun, like doing a thing that kind of distracts me from the world I live in, but also focuses me in a way that is challenging and enjoyable and beautiful and inspiring in a lot of different ways. I like to go back when I'm feeling, you know, sorry for myself about, you know, whatever it is that I'm feeling down about, whether it's needing some time for myself or what have you or whatever. I'd like to go back to trying to just be grateful for what everything that I do have, all the good stuff in the world, just to have like some sort of informal or formal gratitude practice. Mm-hmm. I like to work on myself. I had to work on that a lot, constantly. That doesn't always come easily. I enjoy the rest that I have. I enjoy the time I do have when I don't have something to do. I have to enjoy those moments where I can feel lazy because there aren't that many of them, you know. So I have to enjoy watching shows on Netflix and playing golf, sneaking to play golf whenever I can, because that's my, you know, my reward, if you will, or that sort of thing.
Yeah, you earned that time out there.
Yeah, yeah. You just have to find ways to treat yourself to stuff, mm-hmm. you know, and to like try to spend time with your friends and have fun. It's really important, you know, maybe more important than everything else.
Let's talk about the movement you started on social media, Take Two Knees. It's been a year since that. So can you tell us not only what that movement meant to you and to everyone, all musicians and beyond, and how are you advocating every day for equity, unity, and, you know, social justice?
I started this movement, Take Two Knees, as a kind of a cry out to the world, I think, mm-hmm. you know, because it was May of last year and, like, you know, we were all in a terrible place, yeah. of fear and all of this stuff, and then this violence happened and just kind of a lot of thoughts about how the world deals with the bad stuff, you know, how the world deals with change, how the world deals with protest, how the world deals with people saying what's wrong with the world to try to make it better. A lot of where this came from was thinking about as individuals how we can do anything in times like this, especially during a pandemic. You know, what can we do as musicians, you know, when we're taught to play our instruments? And part of it came from, you know, Colin Kaepernick many years before, you know, trying to protest peacefully on the football stage about police violence and violence against people of color and black people specifically in our country, and how there was a big backlash from some people saying that, you know, you have to stick with what you do. Your profession is all that you can speak about and speak to and do. And you have to be silent about all of the ills of the world. And it struck me during this time, during COVID, that, you know, no one is like out there working pretty much. Everyone's working from home, if working at all. And I was like, wait a second, this doesn't make any sense. You know, people have a right to say what's wrong with the world, especially when it's something that affects them and their families and their communities, and especially when we have a right to speak up about this sort of thing in our country. So the Take Two Knees was a tribute to that, really, to the kneeling down with one knee. And it was my attempt to speak up on my own and say, this is what I think. And I think that if you look back on history, it seems like all of those people that are upset with the slogan Black Lives Matter don't understand that if there were to be a slogan to be upset about, it would be the opposite of that. It would be that Black lives don't really matter in America, mm-hmm. you know, and haven't really for so many years. That would be a more appropriate slogan, you know. And so it was like a commentary on that. And it was a commentary on, you know, who we are as artists, as people, as musicians, and how we choose to communicate the things that we care about or not. And it was my attempt to reach out and challenge others to join me in saying, you know, we believe that Black Lives Matter. We believe that humanity matters. We believe that we should come together on this issue so these things don't continue to happen year after year, decade after decade, generation after generation to so many people. And that's where that all came from. And I wrote a thing, and I played America the Beautiful, and I did that. But it was a very sad time. It came from a feeling of helplessness and hopelessness. And it became something that people joined in because they also felt similarly. That was the beauty behind it. But we are a year away. And it's like you can see that the world has seemingly moved on from everything when really we haven't really progressed. Mm-hmm. We haven't moved forward. And so it just reminds me of where we were and also of how far we have to go to like continue for all of us to look around and say, what's wrong? You know, acknowledge all that's good. People think that you're not acknowledging what's great about your situation, your particular life situation, when you acknowledge that people are suffering around the world. And yet that's not the case at all. You know, mm-hmm. I think it's imperative that people do speak up for those that are suffering in the world, especially if they have gifts and privilege and place in the world, or even if they don't.
By the way, Anthony, did you have a chance to see the trial that just recently ended?
I didn't see the trial. I watched a couple of the testimonials, the testimony of a couple different people.
Yeah, there was a lot of hope that came out of that, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that there was a verdict, the fact that it was taken to trial, first of all. In a way, there are no wins and losses when someone loses their life, you know, but it was definitely legal for the legal world, which a lot of our structures of like power and equality and justice obviously come through the law and what is possible through the law. I think you definitely have to see that as like a pendulum swinging in the right direction for that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I guess it was kind of bittersweet, but more sweet than bitter, you know, that even though justice is something that eludes so many people in the world, mm-hmm. you think that maybe that decision was something that looked more just than other situations.
Absolutely. That leads me into the next question. Nicholas Cruz is going on trial, I believe, in September, and he was the shooter at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. And you performed at that memorial. How was that experience? And why did you accept to be a part of that event?
Yeah, that was, that was another moment in time that, like I said, we all feel so helpless, right? When we see these mass shootings, when we see these individual murders, and we see all this stuff happening in the world, all of the darkness in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And it feels like you can't do anything about it. You can't even contribute to people's peace or help their suffering. And the students from that high school and their music program came to see the New York Philharmonic, and their band director, I think a clarinet player, and you know, one of my colleagues from the Philharmonic went down as well. And we played at the end of year band concert. Of course, which they, and these are the kids that were in the school when that shooter came in. These are the kids that they were just in the building. And I went down there and I played with them, the kids in the band. One of the members of the band was a trombone player who was killed that day. Yeah. It was on Valentine's Day in that year. That's when that happened. Just being able to be in the room with those kids and to know that, you know, they chose to continue playing music. They chose to continue their year. You know, they have to walk into that same building, into that same room. They're hiding under chairs and stuff with an active shooter. And I'm in their rehearsal room, in the band room, rehearsing with them after this, just a month or so later. I mean, it's like, what can you do as a musician besides try to allow people to heal through music? And obviously people aren't going to heal from it ever. Their lives are changed. But for a moment, that's the great thing about what we do as musicians, is that we can be transported somewhere else. We can be moved in a really great, powerful way by our playing of music or listening to music and all this stuff. And so just being able to be there with those kids and play music, make music with them, is the most enjoyable thing for them to do. It's the most enjoyable thing for me to do. And it was a way of light in that suffering, in those moments, to be able to dedicate this concert to those victims. It was just powerful, you know, that the music can unite people. I never met any of these kids before this, any of those students. I didn't know them, but it didn't matter. We were all, in a way, feeling those emotions together as musicians when we were playing that concert. People talk about the power of prayer or the power of good thoughts and all this stuff. And I think sometimes music without words speaks to people's hearts in a way that is kind of simply more, I'd say, genuine sometimes, because sometimes words don't reflect how we feel. We can't say with words. They describe too much in a way. And sometimes music simply just, it is. It just simply is. And sometimes that's what you need after a tragedy like that. You need music to try to help you.
Let's move on to one of the biggest professional decisions you've had to make in your life so far. And that's to move from the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra to the New York Philharmonic. Was that because you prefer symphonic music over opera, or was there another reason?
No, I think playing the opera was like it's a dream job, you know? Mm-hmm. Playing principal clarinet in the Met Opera Orchestra is a dream job, meaning that if I did that job and I performed with that orchestra and I performed those operas for those 10 years that I did and I never played another note on my clarinet, I would have to say that I had a fulfilled life and career as a musician. Mm-hmm. You know, I had so many peak moments of expression and beauty and sheer kind of ecstasy playing in that orchestra. That was that. And the operatic repertoire is beautiful. It's gorgeous. And yet it's not the symphonic repertoire. And I'd never been principal clarinet of any orchestra. I'd only been associate principal of an orchestra, Cincinnati Symphony. Mm-hmm. And hadn't gotten to play a ton of the repertoire, a ton of the pieces as principal clarinetist. So I just wanted to do that. And yeah. So that meant I would audition for symphony orchestras. And that one, of course, being next door, close by, that was an obvious one that I would audition for. So that was just kind of like, as a clarinetist, you audition for orchestras. You audition for great orchestras if you're lucky, or not so great orchestras, you know. And that was just one of the auditions that came up. And that's why I wanted that experience playing in the symphonic repertoire. So that's really why. It's just I hadn't experienced that mm-hmm. enough.
Got it. Do you know what's the performance schedule for the Philharmonic over the summer and next season?
I think that they're announcing the season coming up sometime soon. It's pretty full. It's a pretty full season. It's not as full as it was before, but they, you know, there are a lot of COVID kind of concerns and protocols, and they're redoing our hall again. So we're not going to get back in it for another year or so.
Oh, wow.
So we're going to be, you know, playing in some different venues and doing things like that. So it's going to still be a work in progress. But yeah, they're going to announce the season and we're going to try to do it.
Going on to a more serious note, what are your thoughts on Peter Gelb, and should the Met have taken a pay cut?
My thoughts about what's going on at the Met are that I just don't think that it should be happening like this.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that, you know, you have to understand what kind of company you have when you're hiring musicians and artists to play music, to perform music, to dedicate their lives to your organizations. And when you're in the middle of maybe one of this century's biggest epic health pandemics, tragedies, you know, really, and there is no way to provide support for the artists that make the music, that make the company. I didn't say weekly paychecks. I didn't say anything about pay cuts or contracts or anything like that. But you have to look at what you're talking about when you're talking about not supporting the people that make up your organization for more than a year. It seems to me to be cruel and unusual in its application in regards to the musicians and the artists and the people that make that entire company run. So if the concept is that somehow this is going to save the organization for the next 500 years because you don't pay people in the organization for more than 12 months, that's absurd. Okay. The amount of money that it would take to just, let's just talk about just supporting people whose livelihoods were decimated, completely decimated. No money coming in from the organization that they've dedicated their entire careers to is just cruel and unusual. And so you don't even have to go to the details about the contract or pay cuts or anything like that to understand that that is what is cruel and unusual about this particular situation, that you don't take care of your people. And I think that's a real, real problem. And it's a sickness. I think if there were other organizations, because we're talking about a nonprofit organization here, right? We're talking about a nonprofit. I have a feeling that if this was a for-profit company, I think there would be people on the outside that would know that there was a leadership problem, that there was a board problem here, and there would be people making a stink outside of this organization about it. And I think because of the way organizations that are private and in their own worlds, like musical organizations, that decay can happen at the very top of the organization without anyone being able to do anything about it. And that sort of lack of leadership and decay and destruction of an organization, however temporary, but however meaningful, wouldn't be allowed to happen at a real big company, the biggest for-profit companies in the world, the most famous one. The Met is arguably the most famous non-for-profit company in the world. And for it to be in this state caused by failed, decaying leadership is a real shame.
Yep. Anthony McGill, do you enjoy performing with the New York Philharmonic?
Yeah, I love my job. I love playing music with great musicians. And that's what I get to do, you know, with the New York Philharmonic. I mean, I've been very lucky that I've been with great orchestras my whole life, and this kind of just continues that. I've been with the orchestra for, what, 6-7 years or something? And yeah, I love playing music. That's what I love to do. And that's what I get to do. And hopefully we'll be back doing a lot more soon.
So you are only the third African-American player and the first principal in the history of the New York Philharmonic. How does that make you feel? And do you think that there is extra responsibility to be a great role model for younger players?
I always say it's important to acknowledge those that came before you. Mm-hmm. So the associate principal player that was there before me was Jerome Ashby.
Yep.
And he was a role model for me. He was a teacher of many friends, some of my closest friends. And, you know, I always think about the fact that he got into that orchestra many, 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 many years before I did, and played that job amazingly for so many years. So it's important to mention his memory, because I wouldn't be where I am without people like Jerome and many others before me. So also it's important to remember and to mention that, you know, there were many, many great Black musicians that weren't allowed even this in the same unions as white musicians in America in all of our cities for many, many, many years. And sometimes people don't know that. And so that those numbers don't surprise me at all, because there was just rampant discrimination in our society and in our field. I do feel accomplishing something like that is really, really, it's obviously great for me personally, and it's obviously amazing to have done that. But it also does come with a lot of stuff, you know. It comes with a lot of a lot of extra stuff. I do feel great that I can be up there as the one black face in the orchestra as a demonstration to young people that are coming to the concert, or anyone that, like, yes, we can too play music. You know, like, we can also be on the stage with others. It's, our race doesn't prevent us from playing this music and playing it really well. Because, you know, one would think by the lack of representation on our stages in American orchestras that somehow people somewhere don't think that we can do this or that we do this. And that's an important distinction, because that's what it looks like. You know, that's kind of what it looks like to, like, vast portions of the of our society. You know, outside of classical music specifically, there's like, why, how come, you know, why you guys don't hire any black people here? You know, so, you know, there's a lot of heaviness there. And it's important that, you know, I communicate that, I speak up about that, that I think there's a orchestras should be more diverse, orchestras should have more representation, because it's important. You know, it's important that if we believe that music is for everyone and music should reach everyone and it has the capacity to change lives and do all the things that we all know and love and know that it does, then we need to make sure that we understand what it looks like to the greater population when they see us perform. Because it looks like music's not for everyone, you know, and I think it's really important to be able to communicate that and to try to change that, to try to support allowing auditions to take place in a way that's more equitable, allowing people to come to the forefront that should be able to get access to be able to do so, people to be able to audition for these orchestras. Because people don't know that my first time that I sent in my resume for the New York Philharmonic, I wasn't allowed to audition for the New York Philharmonic because my resume was not approved, you know, like I wasn't somehow good enough.
You didn't even get to play.
No, I didn't even get to play. And that's how orchestras did business for like so many years. That's how orchestras just did business. So you imagine that. I mean, how many people slipped through the cracks over the last, you know, 150 years just because they weren't even allowed to audition based on their credentials, so to speak. Which, as we know, can be interpreted different ways. And so now, of course, everyone is kind of allowed to show up to an audition if they'd like, you know, with lots of, you know, barriers in between. But, you know, that wasn't that long ago.
Do you think some organizations are ahead of others in bringing in more diversity?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think there's like a culture issue in most orchestras, in most organizations, where even within the organization, there can be tons of like kind of conservative or restrictive values about who's allowed to kind of come within our walls. Mm-hmm. And I think that definitely orchestras are maybe bringing up the rear as far as like diversity efforts or even diversity ideas within their cultures. And so I think for sure there are certain people, certain organizations that are attempting to even talk about that as an issue, and the ones that can have the capacity to actually affect changes and to create an environment that is possible to and to do kind of like the research and the hard work and like thinking about what does that actually mean for my organization, that has to start somewhere. So I think orchestras are pretty far away still, but the concept that people are discussing it, I guess, is a good thing. But you have to, you know, you kind of have to do a little bit more than discuss it. It has to be something that you actively try to shift.
On a lighter note, do you think orchestras should dress up in tuxedos?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've never really minded the tuxedos, to be honest, and the tails. But I think, yeah, they could do something different.
Right.
I guess it kind of looks nice sometimes, and some people mm-hmm. love it, but I'm all for like orchestras trying to do things differently. Like orchestras play basically, a lot of the orchestras play the same programs every single year. You know, you'll find a lot of the big orchestras, for instance, play a lot of the same rep with a lot of the same soloists. Mm-hmm. They do things the same way. It's the same traditions of starting concerts, ending concerts, intermissions and overtures and all of that stuff. And it comes from a lot of that same playbook. A playbook mm-hmm. that has worked kind of well for many years, but probably stopped working as well within the last 20. So if you have a company, I would go back to for-profit companies, you have a company that's been doing the same thing or many companies doing the same thing, and then it stops working, that company would go out of business, you know, unless they try to like start changing what is the narrative, unless they try to shift what they can try to do to like be interesting, you know, and relevant and innovative.
Relatable.
All of it. And there's been so much fear as far as doing that, because you do have the subscriber model and you have the subscription model and all of these things that, but you know, all of the big companies in the world have fear of change. But in those places, you can't let the fear stop you from growing, the fear stop you from changing and shifting into the new century or to the new thing. People have had to shift from hardware to software. They've had to shift to the cloud. They've had to shift to blah, blah, blah. The world tells you when it needs to shift, you know, and you need to actually do things better. And better is for a lot of companies now too, not just in music, but better is more diverse. Mm-hmm. Diverse is better, you know, like, and there are so many studies now that prove that. And we're talking about for profit too. And so, yeah, orchestras, we have to get there. And I think some orchestras are trying.
We just heard an excerpt from our guest, clarinetist Anthony McGill, performing Three Smiles for Tracy by Adolphus Hillstork as part of a program Anthony Q curated, inspired by his family's 20th century migration from the Deep South to Chicago, as well as by paintings of Cary James Marshall and others in the Metropolitan Museum collection. Now let's continue by moving on to our second espresso section, where Anthony will give us very quick answers. First word or words that come to his mind. Verdi.
Italy.
Wagner.
Complex.
Stravinsky.
Angles.
Bernstein.
Life.
Florence Price.
Beauty.
Benny Goodman.
Yes.
Tiger Woods.
Great.
Andrew Cuomo.
Complicated.
Barack Obama.
Yes, we can.
Chicago.
My place.
The Bronx.
My home.
Phil Mickelson.
Lefty.
Michael Jordan.
Goat.
Dwayne Wade.
Okay.
The Juilliard School.
A good place.
Curtis Institute.
My school.
Abby McGill.
My wife.
Anthony McGill.
A human.
Well, there it is. Anthony tough. McGill, a human.
That's really weird and tough.
All right, so Anthony, are you aware that there's another Anthony McGill in this world, and he's a famous snooker player?
I do know that.
Would you ever invite him to a duel of billiards?
You know, that would be fun. I like playing pool, actually. Yeah.
But you're competitive, so I'm not trying to, like, you know, talk any smack, but he's most likely going to beat you.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, I think actually that's the beauty of being competitive in the way that I'm competitive in. I don't care about being about losing. I don't mind getting beaten in something, especially not by somebody who's great. Like, would you say, I'm not going to play basketball with Michael Jordan because he might beat me. Like, no. Like, who would say, who is that? Who says that?
So yeah. Are there any similarities between golfing and playing the clarinet?
Yes, a lot of them. How much time do you have?
There are like a ton of similarities. Oh, gosh. I talk about it in my lessons, okay?
Okay.
So playing an instrument takes movement, right? It takes body movement. It takes like a concept of awareness and attention. It involves tension at times, and it involves releasing tension in order to succeed at playing that sport or that instrument or that phrase. They are both things that require a high level of knowledge and skill in order to achieve, but you cannot actively be thinking about those things while doing them to a great degree, especially when you are not at a certain skill level.
Mm-hmm.
They both require many, many hours and many years of study in order to get proficient, better than proficient at them, in order to achieve at the highest level, but also to be doing the technical work at such a level that it is almost like a part of one's self. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm saying that there are golfers. I can pick up a golf club, right? But golfing isn't necessarily myself, but I am a clarinet player. Playing the clarinet is intertwined with my being in such a way that when I play the clarinet, it is like what I am. And golf is, and sport in general, but golf especially, there are golfers and there are those who play golf. And learning how to do so well, and on many different layers, you have to learn different pieces when you play golf. You have to be able to play golf on different courses, which is like playing a vast repertoire of pieces and being able to compete on that level. Being able to play different pieces on the clarinet is similar because there are different pitfalls, different strengths and weaknesses. Similarly, some people are better at certain things than others. And it's about not getting discouraged by the failures. You can learn a lot by failure on the golf course. Yeah. You can learn a lot about, I mean, I could go on forever.
Nice.
A typical wardrobe of Mr. Professor McGill. Are we wearing Armani suits, Brooks Brothers, H&M, or Under Armour?
Typical wardrobe, it involves blue, the color blue, navy blue, any kind of blues, and some sort of blazer, jeans and a blazer.
So when you're ready to retire in many, many years from now, how do you want people to remember you?
I want people to remember me as a teacher, educator, as a passionate lover and performer of music, as someone who had a capacity for kindness and generosity. Yeah, I think that's about it.
Tell us where people can find you online, social media, website.
People can find me at my website, anthonymcgill.com. You can find me at McGill Clarinet on Instagram. You can find me at McGillAB on Twitter, and Anthony McGill on Facebook, a public page, fan page on Facebook. Great. And maybe other places, who knows?
So as we wrap up the show, any final thoughts or something that you would like to say that we haven't covered yet today?
Yeah, I'd like to say I'm happy and grateful that we seem to be moving toward something like a post-COVID era. I feel like so many people we know and love didn't quite make it through the last year, that hopefully we can remember those people dearly and also go forward for the next few years, you know, kind of appreciating what we have here, appreciating what we have to be able to breathe and kind of be around and enjoy the rest of our brief lives on this earth. And sorry, that's so dark.
No, I think it's great. And
no, there's light. There's light at the tunnel.
And for people listening, I think a lot of them know that as performers, we are so eager to be in front of an audience again. And it's a nice reminder of why we do what we do. I'm sure when everything opens up, there are going to be some crazy, amazing concerts. So people should go and support the arts.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you, Anthony. It's been so great to have you here at Down the Pit. We couldn't have asked for a better way to kick off our second season. We appreciate you and all you do to move classical music in the direction it should be going. So it's been absolutely amazing to have you, and thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure is all ours. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for sticking around until the end and allowing us to be a part of your day. We don't have all the solutions to the world's problems, but classical music for sure can help solve a few of them. Please follow us on social media, and we cannot wait for you to join us next time.